This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, July 16th, 2010. I'm Caleb Brown. What binds Tea Partiers together is the federal government's profligate spending and accumulation of debt. What divides Tea Partiers is how best to provide security for the U.S. and whether our wars are justified. So, says John Samples, director of the Cato Institute Center for Representative Government, it's well past time for everyone to treat the military as a true fiscal issue.
Well, I think what holds the Tea Party together as a spontaneous movement is the concern about debt and deficits. There was a concern that was sparked by the healthcare reform when people began to realize about a year ago what that meant. And I think people sort of started to say this was an actual problem rather than just something that might happen in the future. So that's what binds together a bunch of people who have different views about other things.
Tea Partiers are sharply divided on war, that is, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I think it's it would be correct to say that you would expect that many people who identify with the Tea Party are going have in the past supported both the Iraq and the Afghanistan wars. It's not clear to me now that those two wars are either very salient or important for these people, or that the support for it is as widespread as it was in the past. I think one of the interesting things is you don't hear people talking much about it in Tea Party events, and you certainly don't, at least I have not seen, and you don't hear about Tea Party events making the case for staying the course in Afghanistan or Iraq. And in Afghanistan, they certainly, it's been on the front page. You would have heard that, I think.
Is part of that the fact that the management of the war, that is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, is now a Democrat, and Tea Partiers, who are more likely to be Republicans, are maybe less willing to hold water for a commander-in-chief who is managing a war that maybe in their heart of hearts 2 years ago knew was something that was, I'm referring to Afghanistan, of course, knew that something that was going to be a far more challenging war to emerge victorious from?
The evidence we have from the past is never underestimate the importance of partisanship in changing people's minds or changing their behavior or leading them into behavior that's not particularly coherent or rational. So, yeah, that's true. I would expect some of that. One of the odd things about both Afghanistan and Iraq was that the wars over the, if you look back 10, 20 years, both wars were justified by President Bush with rhetoric that was really drawn from the other party, from the liberal tradition, and from things Democrats had said in the 70s or 80s. I think, and ran pretty much against what a lot of Republicans or George W. Bush had said, even in the 1990s. I think there was a case of whiplash for Republican voters. That is, what they had been against, they were suddenly supposed to be for. And that was always there in the background, but they got in line for the most part and became rather pro-war. Now I think that's probably, you know, in a sense, those wars, I think everyone knows, have now are just running out of time and running their course.
We had three Republican congressmen on stage at the Cato Institute earlier this year saying that they recognized the Iraq war to have been a mistake. Mm-hmm. A lot more Republicans now are willing to say that Afghanistan is a mission that has gone astray and that maybe needs to be wrapped up sooner rather than later. Why has this not become more of a fiscal issue in terms of trying to talk about the war as in the context of debt and deficits?
Well, I think if you started talking about these wars in those terms, it would rapidly become apparent that in the background, everyone knows at this point that in these two wars, the United States and the leadership of the United States, and above all, the citizens of the United States, no longer believe that the cost of achieving certainly President Bush's original grandiose plans or even something more reasonable, the cost of doing that are simply something that the American public's not going to pay. They don't see the benefits there. And we've run out in these two long wars, we've run out to that point. So thinking about it in those terms would make that evident, and that would be said in public, and I don't think the leaders at this point are willing to say that. The other side of it is that it would also put, in some ways, the Republican coalition that had been so recently for war would go to the other side of it and define it and frame the war in terms of fiscal conservatism, which would require, again, a big change. And I think maybe voters are ready to do that, but I'm not sure the leadership is.
Terrorism in the years of our most recent President Bush was cast as an existential threat to the United States, to the way of life here. It's hard to come back from that. It's hard to then say, oh, well, that's not worth it.
Right. And I am convinced that one of the things for some time, but particularly since 9/11, the Republican Party sees, or part of the Republican Party saw it as a political advantage to offer to American voters a security, national security, security from terrorism. So in a sense, to walk that back or to give it up is to give up what was thought to be an advantage, in that you can't tell voters, well, we're going to make you more secure than the other guy will. That politicians are pretty loath to give up what they think to be advantages.
Heading into the elections, these midterm elections in 2010, is there anything that can be clearly said about fiscal conservatives, the war, and what these candidates are out there saying?
Well, the one interesting person here, is in so many other respects, I think, is the Senate candidacy of Rand Paul in Kentucky. And he has at various times made two points, which I think are relevant and especially on point for libertarians, conservatives, people like that, which is that he does not deny at all that the Constitution clearly gives a power of national defense to the federal government. It's one of the prime, if you think about Article 1, it's one of the two clearly defined taxing powers that are in the Constitution. So he understands that, but then he says, because the federal government clearly has this power and it's constitutional, doesn't mean we have to be supporting several wars and 750 bases worldwide. So the two have to be separated, and you need to think about, yes, it's a constitutional power, but that doesn't settle any questions. And then I think he's pointing toward what is a reality, which is that we're in a tremendous fiscal bind, and that defense is going to be cut. In the history of the last recent history of the United States, the last 50 years, defense has in fact been the only budget line that moves a lot and can move a lot downward as well as upward. Most things just sort of stay steady or increase. But defense can actually go down, which tells me that in the struggles over budgets, defense has a harder time, contrary to what you might expect. So I think when the pressure comes, defense, just even from just political pressures, is going to be reduced. The question is it done legitimately? Is it done in response to elections? Is this said to the voters beforehand? Are we talking about different strategy in which a smaller defense makes sense? The kinds of things people in foreign policy at Cato talk about? That's the only question. I think the pressures are going to be such that we're going to see a pulling back on defense spending.
The point has been made many times. Friedrich Hayek made the point as well. That is, if you're struggling over in the short term, a finite pie in order to, in the political context, get your budget filled or maximized or growing, among all the budget items, yours must be the one to take care of first.
But in the case of terrorism, national security, the threats that are argued about on parts of the defense budget, it really is the case that I think that President Bush has made those kinds of arguments much more difficult to make. Remember his, in the fall of 2002, in the run-up to the war in Iraq, he evoked the image of a nuclear weapon going off in the United States because the federal government didn't do its job on defense. And then you had the Iraq weapons of mass destruction that were not found. I think, and then it's been a long time also since 9/11. I think that kind of threat has to be existential and imminent in a sense, or within living memory. Frankly, the other side of it is people like Rand Paul can redefine this pretty easily because the fiscal threat is at our doorstep also, as my colleague Jagadish Gokhale has made pretty clear. So I think these issues can be redefined by a sufficiently capable set of political leaders who have the will to do it.
John Samples is author of The Struggle to Limit Government. He is director of the Cato Institute Center for Representative Government. You can order your copy of the book at cato.org.